Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. As part of Film Streams' community development program, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2008 documentary film 2 Million Minutes, directed by Chad Heater. According to Heater, regardless of nationality, as soon as a student completes the 8th grade, he has approximately 2 million minutes until high school graduation to build his intellectual foundation, to prepare for college and a career, to go from a teenager to an adult. The film takes a deeper look at how China, India, and the United States are preparing their youth for the future. The members of the panel are Roger Breed, Commissioner of Education for the state of Nebraska and former superintendent of the Elkhorn Public Schools, Harris Payne, Supervisor of Social Studies for the Omaha Public Schools, Simon Rohde, Social Studies teacher with the Millard Public Schools, and Amor Habab, a recent Duchenne Academy graduate who will be attending Creighton University this fall. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, May 5th, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to begin the program is moderator Caitlin Cruz, a senior at Millard North High School and a member of the Youth Leadership Omaha Ambassadors.
Youth Leadership Omaha Ambassadors are a group of high school juniors and seniors who have chosen to continue with the program after graduating from Youth Leadership Omaha, and basically their students throughout the entire metro, from Gross and Duchenne and even Marion sometimes, to the public schools, both in OPS and in Millard and in Elkhorn. And we found the movie 2 Million Minutes, and it showcases the education in three different parts of the world, three distinct superpowers, and their different views on education. And we thought it can really improve the Omaha community to look at those three viewpoints and talk about how we can try and fix our own, especially when education disputes have always seemed to make the headlines in Omaha.
One thing that struck me when we watched the film was one of the persons they interviewed said that it's not an American students how much they study, but their distribution of time and how they spend it more spread out. How do you feel that applies in each of your distinct areas? If we just want to start with Mr. Rohde on the end.
Great, I have to start first. Well, I would agree with that, and that is something I see. And I have to point out that the program Caitlin's in and I teach, one thing that they have to do, one of the requirements, is they have to do something called CAS hours, Creativity, Action, and Service. And this was actually developed more for the foreign schools to build on the American model with extracurriculars and art and music and sports to try and get these foreign students who really don't participate in a lot of these things, especially through school, to be able to develop a little more in those directions. But I do think that is a major concern when we look at our own country, like you saw, a student working 20 hours a week, or how they divide their time and devote time, particularly with academics versus extracurricular?
Well, right now, I started talking about it, I used to live in Mexico for the past, 14 years of my life. So I'm also trying to, compare, even though Mexico was not in the movie, I'm trying to compare, the Mexican education system versus the United States. And I find that in the United States, we have a ton of extra time for doing extracurricular activities such as community service or being involved in sports or student government. And that even in the movie, they kind of portray it as a bad thing, but I think it's a good thing because even though you're not learning something like math and science, you're able to learn and develop as a person when you grow older. So maybe if you're into sports, you can become a better leader when you're in the field. Or if you like community service, you know your passion is to help others. So you're learning about yourself too in the extracurricular activities when you have extra time, and you know that your school is backing you up in those free time, as you can see, as you can call it.
Well, time is a commodity that's limited for all of us, and what you make of it in our society is one of free choice. With freedom comes responsibility, and your responsibility is to use your free time well. If you don't, one would think at some point in time there are consequences for that, although sometimes those are delayed. But I see in our schools kids that work hard, teachers that work hard. But as Amor pointed out, a lot of times we're working at things that are not academic in nature. They are things that bring forth a well-rounded student, that bring forth other talents such as creativity. I spoke with a person that just returned from China, visiting the schools there. She was repeatedly asked, how do you teach creativity? Well, creativity in our society goes with our freedom. It's a freedom to be creative or freedom to not be creative, freedom to fail or freedom to succeed. If we want to give up our freedom, which is part of the democratic foundations of our schools, then we can perhaps look more like an Indian school or a Chinese school. But that is not the reflection that we want in our schools from our society at this time. And again, if there's one point that I would make tonight, it is that American schools tend to reflect their society, not the other way around.
Well, I think those are very good points that you've made, Commissioner, and that I would like to emphasize some of those as well. I mean, you're doing a cross-cultural comparison, and whenever you start comparing one culture to another, you're going to wind up with stereotypes. I mean, you're looking at a total of 6 kids across the world, and we're going to try to make generalizations about the whole Chinese society and the whole American society, and those are fraught with danger when you do that. I haven't been to India, but I've been to China twice, and I was amazed at the film in terms of the people you're seeing in that film are people of means in China that are sending their kids to very good private schools, but yet at the same time they're comparing the public education system in the United States, which has a very different purpose to that particular school system. And it does not show you in India, or it does not show you in China, the millions and millions and millions of students who do not have an opportunity to get any kind of education like that. And so in a lot of ways, I think you're comparing apples and oranges in terms of these two particular school systems.
But my next thing is, you say we're comparing apples to oranges, mm-hmm. but like just recently in the Omaha World Herald, they had an article about like the significant dropout rate for something for the Omaha public schools. And then you look at the dropout rate for the Miller public school system or the Elkhorn public school system. Like when you look at those kind of things, how do you compare those kind of things? Because that's, in fact, those are two schools. Those are the 3 school systems within Omaha.
I think that's a good point to make. And the point I would bring up is that if you went to China and you looked at people of means people with a higher income, you're going to find that they do get a very good education system. I think if you went to the poorer areas of China, if you went to the poorer areas of India, you would find a very poor educational system, if at all. I think you have the same sort of thing in the United States. What sort of resources are available for kids to learn makes a very, very big difference. I was in Changchun in 2007, and they have a top regional school that you pay to go to that you spend all of your time at. And the teachers there were miffed because, their kids would do very, very well on written exams in math or in science, but they had no practical lab experience whatsoever. And they were wondering how they could get more of that for their kids. In the classes I visited, it wasn't uncommon for the teacher to do the lab experiment and show that lab experiment off to the entire class. Whereas you saw in the United States, the young lady that wants to go off to medical school is getting hands-on experience daily with that type of hands-on learning that's going to teach her an awful lot of science and help her really understand it. And the question we would have, of course, is that the same situation across the entire United States. And I would argue very much that that's not, that we don't have equal resources distributed across the United States.
Does anyone have anything to add to that?
Yeah, dropouts the issue of dropouts is significant, not only in our community, but across the nation. In Nebraska, even a relatively low dropout rate. In fact, a recent ERS study would show that Nebraska, using the method that they chose, not the method that the World Herald recently reported, would have Nebraska rated as the state with the lowest dropout rate across the population. But still, it showed a dropout rate of nearly 11% across the state. That translates to about 3,300 students. That is a tremendous burden and cost on society, and it is well worth us to take efforts to reduce that number by whatever means. But one of the things that struck me when I saw this film was that each of the children was in a supportive family, and that family was focused on education, and that family knew what education meant and knew what the importance of education was in translating that to the activities of their children. That is a basis that allows us to build on schools in schools when that exists in the families. If it does not exist, schools and schools alone do not have the capacity to create that for children. So it is a problem that is a societal problem, not just a school problem.
I just wanted to add, comparing India as Mexico, they're third world countries, and United States is a first world country. I think that the reason many people drop out of high school is because they know that even though they didn't finish high school, there's jobs out there for them to make living. And I know in Mexico you have to study to make a living. If not, there's no jobs for you. So here, because the economy of the United States is very well and there's jobs for every age group or any situations, even though it's not the same that you're going to make if you were a chemical engineer or if you were if you didn't finish high school, I know, but even if you didn't finish high school, you're able to support a family here in the United States.
And I would just like to comment on the apples to oranges comparisons. In many ways, when I use this as a tool in class, one of the things I really enjoy about the movie, actually, is they do seem to have taken some pains to try to make an actual direct comparison in many ways. There is, by no reckoning, Carmel High School is a bad school in the United States. It is a very well-respected, well-recognized school. Notice in the Indian and Chinese classrooms, these are not classrooms with 200 kids apiece. They are very involved. Their teachers are very close. Notice in the science classrooms, there were often maybe a dozen students in there. And likewise, with the comparison, we are looking again at top students in both. The top math student, the class president, what was she, 28th in a class of 900. And these are all fairly accomplished people. And so there are some direct comparisons you can look at. And what you see is when you see the variables, and we, of course, want to avoid the cultural stereotypes, but like you were saying, with the supportive families and what families particularly expect. One gentleman on the film did a very good job of commenting upon, or several actually, that in China and India, with their recent economic rise, there is indeed a hunger, a real desire for upward mobility. And several commented that they're not sure they see that in the United States anymore. And so, to emphasize, I did like how they do, a very good job of trying to show relatively similar situations in a lot of ways. And again, the other thing I always point out with kids is you notice all the students are always saying, I have too much work, no matter where they are. All the students are, almost all of them have a computer in the background on Facebook and email and all that. They all play sports, and we try and say, oh, they don't do anything else, but especially the young lady from China with violin and ballet, and young man from India who plays chess for several hours, they seem to be fairly well-rounded also, too.
Going off of what Mr. Rohde was talking about, something that Youth Leadership Omaha has been talking a lot about amongst each other is something that we've taken to call the privilege through poverty. And we got this back in December when we had a meeting with local businessman Mike McCarthy of the McCarthy Group, LLC. And what we found out was the privilege through poverty in the fact that poverty motivates you to do something. And though not, we can't take away the financial stability of everyone in America, how do you feel that you can instill this in local high school and even at the middle school and elementary level when you can start really instilling those values younger?
Well, I think that's a great idea. And I think the more experiences you get to those kids at a younger level, the better off you are. But I think what the commissioner made a point about and what the film The Economist made a point about is that in some ways these two societies, three societies, are at different levels of economic development. I mean, America today is a sports and entertainment culture. And so, you know, what are kids thinking of when they think of what they want to be? I think to try to get other role models for young people at a very early age and expose them to those different careers is very, very important. But that has to be something that's sustainable and done over a long period of time. If you look at the values that the young engineer had and the mathematician, a lot of those, again, came from a very strong family background. And it's not something that only schools can do. It has to be something that a whole community decides that this is what you're going to emphasize. And again, you know, which is more important, engineers in the state of Nebraska or Big Red football? Which is more important in this town, you know, education or, you know, sports arenas? I mean, we're a sports-oriented and entertainment-oriented society. You know, look at George Clooney coming the past week, you know, how much of an interest that has all over the front page. Whereas when I was in Japan in the mid-90s, they had math equations in the newspaper.
Really?
Yeah, geometry equations. There's a whole different set of values in terms of what the society is teaching to the young people in those societies. And it comes from a long, long tradition of really valuing education.
Okay, Commissioner, like one of your jobs will be to like instill these kind of values and this improve education throughout this. How do you feel like it's the best way to approach a situation like this?
Well, you start an education system basically from people, from teachers. And so one of the challenges I think we have, as was pointed out in the film, you have a whole generation of teachers that were prepared in the late 60s, early 70s, that they're now at retirement age, and some would say that's the pasture I should head out to, too. But the reality is we have to motivate, invite, somehow get a whole other generation of teachers. I mean, literally a generation of teachers. So we look at the millennials, you know, the people born from roughly 85 to 2005. And you seek in those individuals a desire to serve. When you know, and Simon, I guess I would ask you to comment on this also, is that when you talk to kids in high school, as I've done, with a couple examples, and they might be sitting in the back row here, you know, with Zach and his fella up there, that they do not necessarily want the material rewards our society offers. They might want a service. Well, that service, and it relates back to Kennedy's call for service when I was a youngster. That call for service is to do the teaching, to do the building, to do the infrastructure of society, rather than to concentrate on economics and MBAs and things that maybe make businesses run but don't necessarily contribute to the non-material wealth of a society. So I look forward to engaging young people in that discussion of a mission of becoming educators. And, you know, it is interesting that that is the one part of this film that I think would have been an interesting sideline, is to speak to the teachers in each of the three countries as to why they do what they do, what they see, what they have before them each day, why they come back each year. And I think that would have been an important part of the conversation to have.
Mr. Rohde, you were asked to comment by the commissioner on...
Sure, and I would agree with that completely. It's one of the things I think, and I've only been teaching 12 years now, but is something somewhat of a transformation I've seen over the years, is that really I do not have many students now or in the past that have really talked about, like they were saying, the next Bill Gates or anything. Many of them want careers or just really opportunities to try different things, to fulfill different goals. And I think for us as a society, it's a wonderful opportunity because we have a generation really, as opposed to India and China, where upward social mobility is paramount right now, we have the opportunity for a horizontal where most people feel they've arrived. They really don't want to go up, at least socioeconomically, anymore. They want to instead branch out and see what they can do. And it'll be wonderful if, as a society, we can tap into this and see where we can lead it.
On the opposite side of like the dropout rates and the fact that you can't always find teachers coming back is something that Omaha has called brain drain syndrome, is how it's referred to. The fact that students are going off to college in other places where we're going to see students going to Notre Dame or to Brown, places that aren't the great schools that we have, like in UNL and UNO, where there's one of the only Afghan studies program in the country, or even at Creighton and the other colleges in not only Omaha and Nebraska, but in the Midwest. And then after college, they don't return. How do you feel this can be addressed through the educational process?
Well, I think you've got to look at a lot of different mobility issues. It'd be interesting. We always talk about the ones that are leaving, but we never talk about the ones that are coming oftentimes. I grew up across the river in that booming metropolis known as Council Bluffs. Okay. No laughter. It's okay. All right. All right. Yeah, it's a 12-step okay. program. Yeah, I know. All right. I've heard of all the jokes before. So. I can rattle off 10 people that were top people in my class at AL that are professionals over here. They're lawyers, they're doctors, they're dentists. I think you'd find the same thing with students. I've taught at Midland and Dana for about 25 years. Students who come all across the state, and this is where the jobs are at. And so they tend to migrate to the large urban centers. I think the students that I had at North and at Burke over time, the top students do go to other big-time schools. They wind up in New York. They wind up in Chicago. But I'm always amazed, too, is how many of them wind up coming back to Omaha to raise a family because they find that this is it's a good place to raise a family. It's a pretty secure place, and that if the jobs are here, they come back. A lot of my top African-American students that I've had over time do not come back. They go to other urban centers because they have not found the corporate climate here, according to them at least, being receptive to them finding opportunities for employment here. Well, and they have gone to other places.
Well, considering Omaha has the lowest income, like the lowest African-American like income population in America, that's really understandable.
I was just going to say that I remember being a freshman, my chemistry teacher told me, oh, I teach at Creighton. You should come here when you go to college. And I said, I'll rather die than go to Creighton, and that's where I'm going on the fall. So,
never but, say never.
Yes. So, yeah. And what happened is that I'm going to give credit to the Omaha Chamber of Commerce. When I started doing youth leadership in Omaha, I was like, I hate Omaha. I want to move out of here. People in Omaha are farmers. They don't know what they're doing. And they, because I just moved here, Omaha is so tiny. There's nothing to do. And what the Omaha Chamber of Commerce is that they opened this side of Omaha that I've never seen before. They showed me the arts. They showed me how Omaha is so big in health and how we have so many growing businesses. So everything looks so beautiful after it. Like, I remember going on the bus tour, and I told my mom, I truly love Omaha now. And what Creighton happened is that doing youth leadership Omaha with Creighton, I saw, wow, this is such a good school, and it's in Omaha, and it's like close to home, and I've been able to fall in love with Omaha, and I can feel the kinship with the land. Like, I want to stay in Omaha. What I feel is that Omaha should have like more opportunities for every high school student to like fall in love with Omaha and see that Omaha is actually a good place to be. It's a good place to like learn, and it's a good community you can learn. And I just feel like the media, or like the Omaha media, has not done a good job about that. Or or like the parents are not like telling, you know what, this is a good place to stay. And I just got a magazine from the Omaha Chamber of Commerce where there's like these three kids, well, they're not kids, they're like in their 20s, who just came and opened new restaurants and businesses in Omaha because they said that Omaha is a good place to have a business because Omaha is growing, and even though the United States has a lot of economic problems, Omaha has not felt that like hit already. So I think that parents and the media and teachers also need to encourage students to stay in Omaha and show them how beautiful it is, and try to have kids involved in community and have a connection with the people. Because one of the reasons I stay in Creighton is because I'm very close to my church, and I want to see my youth group grow. I want to see Conference for Inclusive Communities grow. I want to see many things that I've done through high school grow. So when I grow, I can like take care of it and see how things are going, because I have that connection. And if that connection is met, people will stay in Omaha.
Well, one thing I guess I would like to see as an educator, and something that we have some control over, is the realization that Thomas Friedman's thesis that the world is flat works both ways. It's not just outsourcing out, but as I believe Harris was saying, what can come in? And as schools, we can really take advantage of information technology. And I would ask, why do we not use such simple and worldwide, relative, very accepted technologies like Skype, instant messaging, just daily in school? Why don't we use video conferencing? I know UNL has a wonderful system where they teach classes simultaneously in Lincoln and Afghanistan and other places. And the professor does it, tells a wonderfully touching story where they have a giant video screen, so the people are life-size. It's not, you know, the little tiny remote camera maybe some of us had done before. And students from Afghanistan had sent clothing to the students from the United States, and the women in the United States are trying it on. A woman from Afghanistan actually reached out to the screen to try and fix part of the clothing, and then she realized, oh, you're 8,000 miles away. But that, to have that human connection, this is something that schools have a real ability to do. We really need to realize, how do we utilize this? And the real advantage long-term in economic development is, so I was saying, the world is flat. No longer do the coasts become the employment center. Students will realize not only that they can start opportunities here, but at relatively low cost, they don't need to leave anymore. And there will be, in a way, they will create more of their own opportunities here if they learn to take advantage of these technologies. And if we can teach these technologies and these interconnectedness and these globalization technologies effectively throughout all years of school, I think that could really give our state and our communities a leg up.
Okay. One thing they talk about is Sputnik, a very big motivator for the American population in the 60s and during the Red Scare and during the communist scare. But we don't really have something like that to motivate us today. But how do you feel that you can instill a motivation from your own point of view as your commissioner of education, your director of curriculum, a teacher, and a student who will be going into the real world soon? How do you feel you can work to, like, what kind of mark can you make on to improve that kind of drive in people?
It's a individual motivation, intrinsic motivation is the thing that I think really makes the difference between students, and that's a hard thing to scratch, because it is so different, and it fluctuates almost day by day with some students as they're going through adolescence and growing into young men and women. But the conversation at the state board is higher standards. Is perhaps graduation requirements that are considerably more strenuous and rigorous than those that exist at this time. So you're probably getting out of here just in time or more. And whether or not those will translate, I think, into motivation, I don't know. The motivation I had was fear of mother. She'd take us out to, had four boys, take us out to the window and show us two mounds out by the honeysuckle plants and say, had a couple other children, they didn't quite make it. You don't want to be a mound out by the honeysuckle plants, do you? And get back and study. When I graduated from high school in Lincoln Southeast, my father said I could have my choice of any major university I wanted to go to as long as it was in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I lived in the basement and shared a car with my brother. That ended my college search pretty quickly. And then the third point, since World War II, we have been depopulating rural and agrarian areas and populating urban areas, not just in this state, but across the nation and across the world, actually. I don't know what's going to reverse that. I hired teachers for 25 years, and I assure you it's a lot easier to hire teachers here in the Omaha area than it is to hire teachers in Axtell, Nebraska, which is 10 miles south of Kearney in central Nebraska, or out in Alliance, which is in the Panhandle. And we have to, I think, seek, as Simon pointed out, those technological ways of extending good teaching throughout the state. And perhaps that comes back to the motivation that we can provide.
Amor?
I would say that competition, it's a great motivation. Maybe if, like, students were more aware that they're in a global world where students our age are, like, geniuses and we'll look not like a lazy pile next to them. Maybe that will make us, like, work. After watching the movie the first time, I just wanted to go home and do homework. So
did you get over that, though?
No.
Oh, no.
And what I'm trying to say is that maybe just know that we're in a world where we're competing against people our age. So competition makes people go crazy. And I think that will be a great motivation to have, like, students try hard in high school.
Okay, Mr. Rohde, answer, and then we have a question from Mitchell.
All right, oh, and I'd build on that. I think that's a very good point. When students do become aware, they do want to rise to the challenge. They do want to go farther. They don't like being called second, ever. So I think that's very useful. The other two I would say, unfortunately, I don't think are very easy, and I'll be honest. The first one is we, as a culture, sometimes do look down upon the educated. One thing I couldn't help but notice was during this recent presidential campaign, when President Obama accepted his nomination, he left out his college education out of his biography video. He just pointed out he went to college. Never pointed out it was Harvard University for fear of appearing too elite.
Is it bad that the President of the United States went to an Ivy League school? Don't get that. Sorry.
That would be my point, is why would you not want to bring that out? And so within the culture, we need to consistently send the message, and not just talk the talk, but walk the walk. We do value this. On a smaller scale, as teachers, parents, and community members, one thing we could definitely do to encourage motivation is we have to realize that our culture has changed. We are no longer in the 50s, the good old days where every, you know, conformity reigned in the memory of people. Students expect more individuality. And to that extent, especially teachers, it's a lot more about personal relationships anymore than the vested authority of the teacher in the front of the classroom. How well we can get to know students, how well we can learn about them as people, and how well we can relate to them, communicate with them, and still be effective leader in their educational careers.
Okay, Mitch, your question.
My question is, the male student from China said that he attended one social event per week, or however long it was. It wasn't many. I just want you guys to comment on how much the social aspect of getting to know people and knowing other people and knowing what they know and, like, who they know, how that affects their success in the future.
In the United States or in China?
Across the globe, I guess.
That's a good point. Yeah. In a free society like ours, I think it is essential to have people skills. And when you talk about 21st century skills, the ability to be diplomatic, the ability to converse on many levels, the ability to learn from other people, respect other people, and in turn receive respect, I think is essential in a work environment. I've hired and fired a lot of people. Rarely is it on the basis of technical skills. Quite often it is on the basis of their poor people skills.
Commissioner, how do you see, like, those communication skills in placed in our students? Because, like,
though, like, competitive speech and debate is something very popular in the state of Nebraska on, like, a both a collegiate and a high school level, like, not everyone is effectively able to communicate their position.
Well, the first thing you do as a parent is you want your child to talk, and then you want them to walk, and then the second thing you tell them is to sit down and shut up. And to a certain extent in schools, we reverse that process. We have them sitting down and quiet, and then what we want them to do is to get up and talk and to communicate and to do that. I think speech, I debated in high school. I'm terrified still of speaking in front of crowds, but that's all I do right now. So I'm kind of getting over it. But the aspect of communication to people is something I think we practice in the very social environments that exist in our high school. I would be concerned about that in the school environment that I saw on the film in Indian China. And so you try not to say that that's their whole world, and I don't think it is, because you saw the one social scene of the students from India chit-chatting out in an alleyway just like our kids would at any free time. But I think our schools actually provide the forum for socializing skills more so than I think other countries. And that may be to our detriment, because the more time we spend on that, the less we get into math and science.
I think it's important that the kids are well-rounded in a lot of different ways. Guitar Hero, you know this program?
Yes, I know nothing about this
program, but I do listen to NPR. Bob will like that. And they had the fellow that's the corporate executive of Guitar Hero was on yesterday. And they asked him in this forum, they said, you know, what kind of people are you hiring out of college? And he wasn't looking, he didn't want math graduates. He didn't want engineers. He was hiring liberal arts people with a liberal arts background that were well-rounded in the humanities is what he was looking for. For just what the commissioner was pointing out is that one of the big advantages of our education system is it teaches that creativity. And that's something you do not find, especially in the Chinese system. It's a lot of rote memory, and they very much want to shift to be more like Americans is what they told me in 2007.
Okay, Mr. Reddy, you had something?
Oh, yeah, I was just going to add, when I first saw this movie, one of the scenes that at first it shocked me and then I had to think about it again was the scene where they're all studying in front of Grey's Anatomy. And I know better than the schedule test on Tuesday or Friday mornings anymore. But at first I was, oh, my goodness, I can't believe they're doing that. And then I realized, you know, how much does that actually reflect perhaps the American workplace? Maybe not with the TV, but the group of people working collaboratively, working cooperatively, actually doing some problem solving. And a lot of that is not just the skills of problem solving and collaboration, but also the interpersonal skills that are extremely important. And like the commissioner said, people have come and gone, but it's usually because they have problems getting along with others or expressing their points of view with others in an effective manner. And so I do think that is a particular strength and something that we work very well with.
Okay, the man who Rachel did in yellow, I believe? Yeah.
The movie didn't really address this topic too much, but I think you guys would have some interesting things to say about it. Can you comment on maybe structural issues in K through 12 and how that contributes to the educational system that we have today, the performance that we are seeing vis-a-vis competitors internationally? Thank you.
Calendar. Structure of the school day, that type of structure. Whatever, okay. Well, I'll talk about those two. I'll answer my own question. Again, as I said initially, schools are a reflection of the society that spawns them, particularly in a free society. We started out with a school calendar that reflected the needs of an agrarian society, particularly here in the Midwest. If we were to start a school system tomorrow, I doubt very much that we would select the calendar that we have now. I think the days would be longer. I think the year would be organized differently. And I do not think there would be a 90-day break in the summer. But here's the problem that we have with the school calendar and with much of what happens in our schools today. Because another thing I would suggest is divorcing all interscholastic activities from schools. We'll call that your idea.
Thanks.
Or yours. Not
I'll
mine.
Take credit.
But, you know, because if you're truly focusing on academic issues, our kids, our teachers are as good as anybody in the world. It is a matter of time and focus and the will of our society to provide the time and the focus to do that. We've not shown that will. I have bleeding scars from mentioning that maybe we should have a year-round calendar. I have bleeding scars from mentioning that we might lengthen the student day. While both of those seem commonsensical, because when you look at the number of minutes that was shown right at the end, it's amazing that we score as well as we do internationally, given the limited time we concentrate on those subjects. I think that's a credit to our teachers and to some extent to our students. But time is an issue, and how society wants us to dedicate its time, how society wants to look at the culture that has surrounded our school year as it is now. Because when you go to change the calendar, it's not just parents and kids you deal with. It's employers. It's the sports and fun subculture we have in our society. It's the vacation industry. It's many, many small businesses that count on student workers. But it is not a calendar that lends itself to good education. We know for a fact that our most recalcitrant students suffer the most in a 90-day break.
That's right.
And they would be better off remaining in school to some extent if we could do that. So when you talk about systemic changes, the system, that's kind of where I would start, is looking at calendar. But remember, it's his idea.
Thanks.
I'd just like to say from high school students, kind of encroaching on a Moore's territory, but like my school day in actual academic classes is 6:50 to 4:15. Like I take two extra classes, and like I take a lot more academically rigorous courses, and like it's true when you push yourself to that kind of thing, it does would lend itself more to a year-round school calendar, and that kind of stuff it's detrimental to have those long breaks that don't actually, that are like time for you to forget and relax, but you still forget.
When I was in Mexico, in junior high, we had from 8 to 10 subjects a day, and obviously the days were longer, and here when I first moved here, I thought the classes were extremely easy and we had study halls. And in Mexico, that's not real, and I can tell from the movie, China and India don't have study halls either. So sometimes I guess that it will be better if there were more subjects, because you can learn more things throughout like your high school. And I guess that so much free time during the, like, I'm not saying that I don't like study halls. They're lovely, but sometimes it will be better to learn something during that time or have more classes and, like, have three sciences, biology, chemistry, and physics, the 4 years of high school, not just focusing, like, 1 year in physics, 1 year in chemistry, 1 year in blah, blah, blah. It will be better for the structure.
A couple of comments and a question. First of all, the assumption of the movie is that science and math is the holy grail.
Right.
And I would totally disagree with that assumption. Right. You made the comment about liberal arts.
Yep.
I would make the point, no offense to Millard, I think it's a great school system, that Omaha Central is not duplicated in India or China culturally, diversity, or the quality of education you get as far as liberal arts. Second, I'm kind of amused by the Omaha brain drain. I'm looking at Casey, who's a brilliant writer who went to the University of Missouri, who's back in Omaha. Rachel, fan of Film Streams, went to Illinois, New York. She's back here in fan of Film Streams. So from the resumes I see at a law firm, which are absolutely amazing from all over the country, I think the brain drain here is a myth based on what I've seen happening in Omaha. Third, and this is a question for all of you, what do you think of the D.C. school system and the merit issues that are being raised as far as teaching in the D.C. public schools and the commissioner emphasizing merit among teachers? Because I understand there's issues among our education, but when you say that math and science is the holy grail and nothing else is going to be evaluated, we'll come out second best most likely. But I'm curious about the merit issue as far as the teachers and what's happening in D.C. and the public schools.
You're talking about...
The commissioner of the D.C. public schools.
Yeah, Commissioner Rhee.
Yeah, who basically is evaluating all teachers based on her standards of merit. And we don't have merit, as far as I can tell, in the public schools in Nebraska.
Well, and you're attaching pay to student performance as a definition of merit. That's what Commissioner Rhee is doing. And you can do that. It's based on some assumptions that I think you have to recognize may or may not have merit in and of themselves. One of the assumptions is that teachers today are choosing, knowing what to do and choosing not to do it because they need then the assistance of some higher authority to redirect them. I've not found that the case of teachers that I've worked with for the most part. The second one is there is a 60-year research on merit pay for public employees that shows it basically doesn't work. And it doesn't work, and they'll premise several reasons why. One is the first issue that I mentioned that, you're trying to modify behavior through a merit evaluation plan. That assumes that you know how to modify that behavior is one thing. And secondly, that you have a system that can identify the behavior that is happening and what is necessary to modify it. But third and most importantly, most merit pay failures is that they do not provide sufficient either support or finances on a consistent long-term basis to make them actually turn the ship. And I think Commissioner Rhee will fail in D.C. because the status quo is significant in that school district. And that's not necessarily a good thing. I think she's attempting to do the systemic changes that were asked about before, and there are some things to that. That would be one of the last things that I would try to do because it just evokes such emotion amongst teachers and evokes such a negative reaction. I would counsel a better way to do that is to create the supportive models of teacher performance. Dedicate teaching coaches, literacy coaches, reading coaches, math coaches to actually expand the supervision of teachers so that the proper things are occurring on a consistent and focused basis in classrooms. And the schools that have turned around their achievement the best, regardless of the socioeconomic status of the students, and this would include in the Washington, D.C. public schools, have been those that got their teachers all pointed in the same direction, working in the same basic instructional model, and being supported with that over time, because it does take time. The kindergartners that are joining us next year will not graduate from high school until 2022. And I have no idea what the world's going to be like in 2022. But, you know, that's, again, my personal opinion. I run into people every day that tells me if we just had merit pay, if we just tied teacher performance to student performance, things would change. Well, I've been married to a math teacher for 39 years, and the only thing that would change in our household with a merit pay system would be I'd be sleeping in the doghouse, so more so than I already do.
Mr. Reddy?
Yeah, I just wanted to address the liberal arts because I actually led back into the structural comment I wanted to say is one thing I noticed, and I noticed that too about the video, is it's very focused on the math and the science. And one structure I would address is with the liberal arts is that those are very hard to assess in the proper format. They do not lend themselves well to the multiple choice statistical control testing. And if you want to assess these well, and assessment has an extremely important place, it requires a lot of resources. if you want students to consistently write and have consistent feedback and have eyes looking at these things on a frequent, regular, consistent basis, this takes quite a commitment from anyone that does it. And in the video in particular, that's a lot harder to show. It's just, it's so much easier to go to very quickly a standardized math test, this percent right, this percent wrong, as opposed to more qualitative assessment system used for liberal arts.
It, to kind of bounce off of that, you know, it's very tough economic times now. A lot of people are losing their jobs. I feel, you know, horrible that this sort of situation has developed in America. At the same time, I got a nice email from a friend of mine at Chadron, and she is losing her job. She's a professor. She's worked tremendously hard. She's developed the relationships that Mr. Rohde was talking about. She's doing a great job with her students, and they're cutting her program and her position next year. At the same time, in the state of Nebraska, we gave our football coach a multi-$100,000 raise. You know, what message are we sending to young people when we do that? I mean, you know, we're missing the point there. And back to your point about merit pay, you know, that's fine, but who gets the merit pay? You know, if it's the kids in the top achieving schools and the teachers in the top achieving schools, where are the top achieving teachers going to go? You're talking about the dropout rate. At the same time, you know, are you pouring the resources in to those schools to actually make an impact on those? And, you know, I'm glad the commissioner brought up the fact that it's more about, you know, caring about those kids. But if you start giving merit pay only to these top-end teachers in these schools that have top-end achievement, which, again, strongly correlates to the economic level of that particular area, bingo, what's going to happen? You're going to be sending a message to those really good teachers, or those teachers who are putting their hearts into trying to help those kids that are struggling the most, that they're not doing the right thing. They're not going to get the most pay. They're not going to get rewarded for what they're doing. And I know I've got one in the third row up there. He puts his heart and soul into things and it developed all kinds of neat programs at South High School. And I think Central High School has a great reputation, and it has a great school culture there that ties itself back to the history of that school. And I think if you want to look at changing a school structurally, it's to tie into those histories and to make our society proud of education. Because that's very much, I think, what you saw in India and what you saw in China. And I'm afraid over the last, I've been an educator now for 29 years, and when I first started, a teacher was held in high status in our society. And I'm afraid now, year after year, it looks like more and more like we're becoming fast food employees. I mean, our particular status in the society has become lower and lower. The media's bashed us. There's all sorts of things that have made the teaching profession tougher and tougher. And as Mr. Rohde pointed out in summary here, that, you know, a lot of students don't want to go into the teaching profession anymore, not like they used to. And that's got to change in America if you're going to structurally, as you said, make a difference here in the state of Nebraska or in the United States.
Okay, I guess it's time for final thoughts. Just like what you feel we can take away from the movie as an Omaha community about our education system, how we can help not only like the students but your own kids. Just your final thoughts on what you take away from the film.
I'll start.
Go ahead.
India and China spend approximately 10 to 15% of their gross domestic product in education. The United States, while we appear to spend a lot, as Mr. Takechi pointed out, we spend roughly 2% of our gross domestic product. So the next time when you're confronted with a tax issue that involves the schools, you might think of it as an investment issue in our future. And that would be the message I would have for not only the Omaha area, but across the state and across the nation.
I was just like, one, like, to tell, like, I see most of the people here in the audience are adults, and I guess like most of you have kids or have had kids or whatever your situation is. I think that one of the reasons that I've tried so much in school is because my mom has always been there, like, pushing me, even though sometimes I think it's annoying or it has worked. And also my teachers, like, they push me to think critically. And for you who are teachers, like, thank you, because in the world that's what you need to do. And I realized that, like, maybe if you don't have, like, the highest GPA on school or something, but if you're smart and if your parents are backing you up or your teachers, and you know that you have the skills to become somebody in the future, you'll be successful. So parents sometimes, like, the kid's mom in the movie makes me mad. Oh, he does enough. I was like, no, he doesn't. And the parents from China and India, they were like, we want more from him, and like, they were very brilliant. So I think that if your parent, you need your parents to be pushing you hard, because they know, like, parents know their kids and they know the kids' limits.
I have two thoughts. One is that I think films like this are a wonderful opportunity to start discussion on what it is we really want. And we all say what we really want or think we have an idea of what we really want, but sometimes we kind of backtrack on that a little. We're not necessarily completely sure of what that will look like. And so when we have these comparisons with others, we can kind of see it and reflect upon our own practices. The other thing I think is really important to take from this is, and I believe the former Secretary of Labor pointed out, it's not a zero-sum game. This is not some type of worldwide educational global death match here where one side wins and the other side is vanquished. The high tide lifts all boats, and in a fully integrated globalized world, it's not a matter of life or death or survival and failure. It's more a matter of what opportunities are open to us, that we can go and do more now than the previous generations, but we have to be aware of what that is going to take and how we can get there.
Mr. Payne?
Just two quick points. One, I'd reiterate what the commissioner said. We spend more on dog and cat food and taking care of our dogs and cats in the United States than we do on education. And I love both my dogs dearly, believe me. But I think it's important that we realize that that is our future generations. And, you know, I don't like paying my tax bills as well as anybody else does. But when I sit back and really think about it, you are investing in the future if that's what you want to do. Secondly, I think it's good to see a discussion like this because I think you got a lot of different points of view other than just what you saw in the film, and it's really good to see, and it's really gracious of FilmStreams and the League and bright young people to bring together a group like this to discuss educational issues. I wish we had standing room only in here is all. Thank you.
You've been listening to a panel discussion on Noon Forum, which followed a screening of the 2008 documentary film 2 Million Minutes, directed by Chad Heater. The event took place at FilmStreams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema, as part of their community development program. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, May 5, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The members of the panel were Roger Breed, Commissioner of Education for the state of Nebraska and a former superintendent of the Elkhorn Public Schools, Harris Payne, Supervisor of Social Studies for the Omaha Public Schools, Simon Rohde, Social Studies teacher with the Millard Public Schools, and Amor Habab, a Duchenne Academy graduate who will be attending Creighton University this fall. The moderator was Caitlin Cruz, a senior at Millard North High School and a member of the Youth Leadership Omaha Ambassadors. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Laura Shainrock, Casey Logan, and Jim Foyt of FilmStreams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.